This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 12th of October 2009 here in Japan, and joining me on the line today is Jordan Kaufman, the host of Corruption Radio on KDWN 720 AM Las Vegas on Saturdays from 9 to 10 PM Pacific, and online at corruptionradio.com. Jordan, thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, as it is your maiden voyage here on the Corbett Report, perhaps we should start by introducing yourself and what you do for the listeners out there. So tell us a bit about your background and about Corruption Radio.
Sure. Well, I mean, I have about 10 years experience in the technology sector. I had been involved in various campaigns before I sort of disavowed any kind of direct involvement in politics. And on Corruption Radio, kind of what we do is, instead of just getting caught up in the kind of left-right divide and the kind of the arguments of the day, you know, we try to, you know, make history come alive and show how it affects what's going on right this second. So we bring people up to speed, you know, from the past and kind of show the kind of corrupt beginnings that leads to what people are discussing today.
Excellent. Well, that sounds very good. So you have corruptionradio.com, and are there any other ways for people to access your work?
Corruptionradio.com is the primary way. Of course, it is a live show on KDWN, they can also subscribe to the podcast. They can do it from corruptionradio.com or kaufman.podbean.com. That's how they can get the show. And so, yeah, each week our live broadcasts each week go out through the podcast as well. And occasionally we have some special messages we put through there as well. And all the blog posts are also on corruptionradio.com. So during the week, you can get an idea what the next show will be like.
Excellent. Well, I've come across your work recently, but I was quite impressed with an episode of Corruption Radio that you put together on the topic of the smart grid. And this is a huge topic, and I'm not sure which way around you want to approach it, because, of course, it's heavily connected with IBM, which, as a corporation, has an interesting history that lends some context to this topic and why it's such a concern. But, of course, there may be a number of people out there who aren't even sure what the smart grid is exactly. So would you like to go over a little background and historical context first, or explain what the smart grid is first?
Sure. Well, first off, IBM is clearly not the only company that's going to profit from the coming control grid that's coming up. But they are certainly at the forefront of it, and they're the most interesting to analyze because the company has such a long history going back to the late 1800s. So we can really look back and see the culture that was involved in IBM and see a long history of government and corporate marriage that at times has the appearance of being benign, but at other times really has their fingerprints on some real horrific history. So, for example, we know with regards to Nazi Germany that IBM really was instrumental in helping the Nazis to organize their society so that it can be controlled from a central Nazi command. And so, for example, we all see in the movies where, you know, the Nazis kind of come into a neighborhood and they have a list of people that are Jewish and they go in and grab everybody and round them all up. A lot of times, and if people have heard, what's interesting is people have heard a lot of these details, but don't know why. For example, people know that people were called out as being Jewish who didn't even know that they were Jewish because they were 1/16th Jewish, or their family had converted 4 or 5 generations back. So where did the Nazis get these lists? And the disturbing truth is that they got these lists because IBM helped them to organize all their records, all their baptismal records for the past, leading back to the year 1800. In other words, the baptismal records showing conversions. They also helped them with their racial census, they also helped them to organize when they would be dropping off Jews, truckloads of Jews, when they would get to a concentration camp. They would, based on their card sorting machines, because this is really pre-computer, but their card sorting machines worked just the same as our modern-day computers do today. and with the same idea, only every calculation had to be mechanical, which means that everything they wanted to calculate, every application, if you will, of these physical sorting machines had to be programmed by an IBM technician. So when they would drop off a truckload or trainload of Jews, they would also drop off their punch cards. Each Jew would have a punch card that they would sort quickly, and within several minutes they would know which group would go to be executed, which group would be put to office work, which group had medical backgrounds that they could use in their hospices, which groups would be worked to death in a work labor camp, and which ones would be suitable for medical experimentation. And IBM created the applications for them so that they could execute on all these things.
Well, that's right, and all of that was very ably documented. Actually, stunningly enough, I guess it's such a central point about the Holocaust and how it was organized, but it was never really researched until, I think, early 2001 when Edwin Black came out with IBM and the Holocaust, which is really the first time that information was really assembled, and he did a lot of that research himself and through volunteers. So that's a vital point of Holocaust research that was only recently really uncovered and unearthed. But playing devil's advocate, please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that really is an excellent book, and I'll just point that out, that's a rare book, because a lot of books come out, you know, every time there's a president, there's, you know, 100 different books about hating, you know, people that hate Bush or hate Obama or whatnot. And what's interesting about that book is that it really is, he was the first person to assemble all the documents, and he had access to the IBM archives. He had access to in various different countries. He had people helping him. So yeah, that is really a rare book, because it really does provide a look into things that really there's no easy way to get a hold of that information beforehand.
Right. Well, just fleshing out that point a little bit then, I guess just playing devil's advocate, I know there may be some people in the audience who might say, well, oh, that was half a century ago. That was a different time, a different place.
Sure.
That was IBM Germany. So what relevance does that have to talking about what IBM may be up to these days, do you think?
Sure. Well, that's an excellent question, and we definitely want to talk about what they're doing today. But I kind of think of World War II as being kind of one point, and our currently what they're doing is being another point. And the bridge between that, in my mind, is the fact that really these things have never been acknowledged by IBM. When Edwin Black came out with this groundbreaking research, It was obvious that their response to it was to minimize it and forget about it and act as if the Nazis took over IBM Germany, which is a distortion. IBM Germany was never taken over. They manipulated their accounts a little bit. They froze their accounts at one point, but they didn't run IBM Germany. And so that to me is, because people can change, and of course organizations change as well, right? There are certainly, you know, there are various different organizations that have, like, for example, the Catholic Church and whatnot that have kind of, or even the various different religious groups that have kind of, you know, apologized for things in the past. And that's not something that has existed. So that's the bridge between then and now. And what they're doing now is very interesting because it's really on a global scale. They're lobbying nations around the world to put in various different systems of organization, like, for example, I don't know which pieces you really want to get into or cover, but I'll just mention one of them for now is their license plate recognition software that's being used in Sweden. And what's interesting about this is that they have the precision down so well, where basically the point of the system is to recognize every car that comes in and out of Sweden. And they do this by not enforcing people to carry a transponder, but with a set of video cameras that recognize the license plate with stunning accuracy and can track out of 500,000 cars that pass the camera's view, they only miss about three or four cars. They miss identifying them. So they identify the car, and then their car is charged based on the time of day they're traveling to avoid peak traffic time periods. There's a graduated scale for what they charge you, and at the end of the month you get a bill. And that's just kind of one example. And, of course, the stated goal of it is to reduce traffic, which it is effective in doing. And but it is a little disconcerting when you compare it with the other aspects that are of what they're doing right now, and of course the historical context.
Exactly, it's like once finding one piece of a jigsaw puzzle, and you don't quite know what that piece does until you see the other pieces. But just on that Swedish license plate scanning system, one of the interesting points that struck me when I was listening to your podcast was that apparently, I guess the Swedish government had hired a team of lawyers to deal with complaints about this when they were first instituting it, but they didn't quite get the flood of complaints they were expecting.
Right, you know, it's interesting. There was only like 5 or 6 people that that objected and that have tried to appeal, because those lawyers were meant for appeals. And there was really no reason to hire 40 lawyers to handle 5 appeals. And so they were really taken aback by that. And not only that, IBM also hired part of the contract that they sold to Sweden include one of the, in other words, it's not just a lump sum contract, right? They have to itemize everything. One of the items was for a call center to deal with complaints in addition to the appeals. And the calls never came. I mean, those, you know, there was obviously no reason to even have such a department. But they did circulate a number for people to call and complain. So it is very interesting that that there's when people, you know, think that this is going to be difficult to spread, you know, from Sweden. I don't buy that. I think that this is going to be very easily accepted. And it's, you know, of course, these all their operations were easily accepted in World War II, but we have to remember that the technology was much more primitive. And because besides this network of video cameras don't sound very, very complicated, but how do 500 out of 500,000, how do all but 4 or 5 get recognized? There's some very powerful computing power behind that, and I don't know if that's something you're going to get into.
Well, it's certainly something that we should get into, but just on the license plate scanning note, I fear that you're right, that people will simply accept it. Even just from my hometown of Calgary, Canada, I recently had a news story pop up. I was scanning the local news, and apparently they've instituted a new law for people who are parking in the city. And instead of parking meters, they're now using a system where people will actually have to plug in their license plate meter, their license plate number in some way into a system, which will then be downloaded by the parking authority, which will then go around with license plate scanning cameras to scan the license plates of everyone in each parking spot to make sure that they're registered to be there. And apparently, since Calgary is a jurisdiction in which people don't need a license plate on the front of their cars, there's now a new law that people have to park front in so that the back end is showing, so that they can read the cameras without getting out of their car. So, and the only complaint that people had was that they now have to park in a different way. It wasn't about the license plate scanning cameras itself. So again, people can be inured to this and inculcated in it. But as you say, this is just one particular aspect of a much, much larger system. So why don't we start by taking a little bit of an overview of some of the technologies that are involved, and then we can look at some of the pieces of that.
Sure. Well, okay, so we discussed the traffic grid, the control grid on with regards to traffic and coming in and out of cities. There's also a power grid, and again, I mean, I don't want to miss the amazing technology that is out there and some of the benefits that are purported. I just really think that it's not the full issue. For example, you know, a lot of these things people can find in like the May 4th issue of Fortune, and the reason I bring that out is just so that, you know, people know this is not, you know, it's just some fringe idea that we're bringing up here. You know, this is, you know, they advertise it publicly on there. If you watch their advertisements or if you include it in your podcast, I don't know. But they're very public about it. I mean, they want to get people to like this idea. So this is, you know, this is right out there in the open. So you have the power grid. One thing that the power grid is going to do is be able to get a better view into the individual usage of people and with regards to their power consumption in their home. And so, in other words, and you've even seen some commercials. I believe there's a GE commercial, a Whirlpool commercial. And again, these companies are oftentimes interlocked. And where, you know, they have kids making a comment about how, you know, that now they have a smart washing machine that tells them that they should do the dishes at 11:30 p.m. when there's not when there's a lull in the usage of energy. And so that's a little peek into kind of where they want to go in that direction. In addition to that, you have medical records. Of course, medical records are going to be something that's going to want to be centralized, and they're going to want a vision into. And it's really, you know, when you start seeing all these different areas that they really want to know everything about what you do. And really at the center, right, because there's various different applications, and IBM will continue to come out with new ones. They all fall under what, of course, you're aware of, is called the Smart Planet campaign. And really at the center of the, technologically speaking, the center of the Smart Planet campaign are these petaflop computers. Now, just to maybe, if your listeners can try to visualize what a petaflop computer is. It's a machine, a computer, that can process 150,000 calculations every second for each person on the planet. So for all 6 or 7 billion people, for each one of those individuals, they have a computer, a single computer, that can process 150,000 calculations about you, about me, about everybody. 150,000 calculations per second. And that's just where they're at right now, and that's just one of these supercomputers. So that's what's at the center of all these various applications.
Right, and that links into a lot of other technologies that are being worked on that that will provide a forum for ubiquitous computing, whereby every object that we have, even our clothing, will have microchips embedded in them that will be scannable and readable and trackable, and of course will be able to provide that smart grid where, for example, you walk into a store and the store already knows your measurements so that they can provide you with a tailored suit or something to that effect, or that's the Minority Report type world that we're moving into. So there are so many different ways in which this will affect people's day-to-day life. But let's start...
Let me just comment on that. Before we go forward, let me just comment on that for your listeners, right? Because what you just said to the average person on the street, if you just said what you just said, it would sound very strange, very fringe, but what you're saying is completely mainstream to people that are aware of the technology. So I just wanted to comment about that there is actually a clip you can find on YouTube where there's a clip from the Advent conference, which is Siemens conference, which Siemens is a large company, not as large as IBM, but it's very mainstream, and they talk about how these the chips, where they can identify the products, are going to be sold for less than a cent per chip. So, in other words, if they, you know, they buy these things by the billions, and for less than a penny each. So that makes them cheap enough to put on the product, because what they want to know is they want to get into the mentality of people when they pick up a product in a store, they walk around, they see a cheaper brand, and they put it back, and then they take that. They want to understand people's mentality to such a degree so that they can, you know, be manipulated further. And so this is something that they brag about, and they talk about how, you know, how this is ready right now. So this is not a fringe topic. I just wanted to make that clear when you bring up things like, you know, microchips being in all of our products. This is 100% mainstream idea.
Absolutely. There's absolutely nothing fringe about it. And in fact, the people in the know are having conferences about it and writing books about it and talking about it all the time. So
right.
I would suggest people go to a search engine and just type in the phrase ubiquitous computing and see what comes up, because this branches out into some of these areas. But let's start taking a look at some of the specific ways this will affect people's day-to-day life. Of course, we've talked about a little bit about the smart power grid and how that might work. But I guess this goes back to of course, Obama during the campaign was talking about how people won't be able to have their air conditioner set to the whatever temperature they like and things of that sort. Can you talk a little bit more about how that might be implemented and how that might affect people in their wallets and in their homes?
Right. Well, you know, the interesting thing is that it's not going to come in the form of, you know, people busting down your door and breaking your things and things like that. This is going to be much more subtle Because remember, these campaigns of kind of gaining control over people's individual life have had a long history, and people are much more tuned on how to get these things done. So what would likely happen is the individual power consumption, once they have these, because there's an expression they use called smart networks. So in other words, the idea is that the power, let's say the power grid, for example, that's considered a dumb network by IBM consultants because they cannot get visibility into the individual. For example, when power goes out in your neighborhood, the way they actually figure it out is where it's at is relatively primitive. They get complaints, right? They'll wait till they get maybe 5 or 6 calls from people saying the power's out. And they triangulate where it's at, and they have models for calculating that. And they figure out, they kind of triangulate based on the calls, and they send out somebody to go looking for a tree that fell on some power cable. And based on that, the person will find it, and then they will tie it up and kind of route the power around the broken connection. So what they want is sensors everywhere, so once power goes out, they can immediately know where it's at because they'll see the sensors that are still online, and this is actually very simple technology as far as the sensing, the individual sensors. And the real marvel of the technology is the computing of all these simple sensors, millions of simple sensors in a centralized computer. So that will also get into your house. Now today we know it's still common for power companies to send out people to go read your meter. And remember, the meter, when they go read your meter, they really don't have specified information. All they know is between the last reading and this reading, you've used X amount of energy, and they can charge you appropriately for that usage. But what they want is they want to know how much power are you using right now, right this second. And then the same way that they want to kind of smooth out traffic by punishing people for coming in during the peak hours, they want to smooth out the power usage. And so in that case, you would most likely be charged at a graduated scale. So if you wanted to use your power from 6 p.m. to, let's say, 8 p.m., when most people are getting home from work and like to, you know, do their errands and take care of laundry, you would most likely be charged an extreme premium for that. And it's important to note that you really could not do that today. That's impossible without the technology. And so they don't come right out and say, you know, we want to, you know, charge on this, you know, on this scale. First, they just say, well, we want to have a smart network so we can fix power outages, and you know, they'll tell you all of the positives in it, of course. And then once it's in place, then they can really do whatever they want with it.
Exactly. Well, that's really the point, isn't it? It's always set up for the best of reasons and what sounds like good ideas. But ultimately, what you're doing is giving the power to bureaucrats and faceless politicians who are the same people who deregulated the California energy markets in such a way that Enron was able to make billions of dollars using schemes like Operation Death Star and other funny little scams right. like that they were playing. So obviously there are serious
right.
problems.
And again, remember, they do play with those words. You know, when they say it was deregulated, it's not a coincidence that, you know, every time you hear the term deregulated, it's usually in a negative context, right? Like, for example, the way that the current financial crisis, not to get off topic, but current financial crisis is characterized as they deregulated just because they, you know, repealed Glass-Steagall, which is true. They removed some regulation, but you know, it's extremely, you know, the financial crisis is, you know, extremely regulated, and you know, the banking industry has gone in the direction of more regulation since the crisis, and you know, will continue to do so. But yeah, you're absolutely right with regard to what happened in California. They kind of deregulate part of the system, but keep the rest of the system kind of under control, and it usually allows a pocket where, you know, one company that is very close with a large group of politicians is able to kind of come in and have preferred profit arrangement.
That's exactly right. That's an important distinction. Rather than deregulated, it was more like re-regulated in such a complex way that only a few people were really able to understand how to play the system. And unfortunately, that was a company that was really not in for people's best interests. And yet again, now we're partnering with companies like IBM or Siemens or other groups that are trying to implement this technology and hoping it will be for the best. But let's take a look at another example of this type of technology, and one that I think will get people where it counts, which is in their body. And an example of that came out just recently, October 5th, 2009. BNet.com reports, microchip implant to link your health records, credit history, social security. And that headline sends chills down my spine, but perhaps you can explain maybe what that means for people out there who aren't similarly affected by that.
Right. Well, again, you know, sometimes on my radio show, I like to break down, you know, here's what we know and here's what may be. You know what I mean? So we make a distinction between, you know, what's the cold hard facts. And the cold hard facts is that, again, Verichip, which is a company that is actually, whenever you hear Verichip, you have to think IBM, right? Because Verichip is essentially funded. A lot of people don't understand about IBM is that they have a large amount of capital that they use, sort of like a bank or a venture capital firm, if you want to think about it that way. And so basically, Verichip is in existence because of IBM and because of partially because of their funding. So what Verichip is they, again, they create a, and I had Jason Burmis on my show, and we talked about some of the updates about that, and it used to be a grain of rice. The size of a grain of rice is this chip with a 16-digit number or something to that effect that uniquely identifies you and will, again, hold your medical records, hold everything that's about you in this chip. And now they've gotten it down to about a third of a size of a grain of rice. And what IBM and Verichip are doing is, again, lobbying governments around the world to get their government employees. They start with the ultra-sensitive government employees, and they forced them to get the chip implanted, and this happened in Mexico in 2004, I believe 2005. They required many of their agencies for their people to get chipped, and so that's kind of stage one. And you know, again, it's not really forced in the sense that, you know, if you want to go work somewhere else, you can go work somewhere else. But it's, again, there's a lot of collusion between government and corporations that depend on government assistance. And, you know, there's things set up like in the United States called InfraGuard that engages certain corporations with the government and so that there's this cooperation. So it'll likely spread from the government agencies, and it'll become pandemic in government agencies, then move into the corporate world through the InfraGuard arrangement or similar relationships in other countries, and then eventually it will be generally accepted. I don't know that they're ever going to force, I doubt they're ever going to force people to get it. What's going to happen is people are going to demand it, and that's a much, much better way to run things for yourself. I mean, if you're the ruling group, isn't it better to get people to demand something from you, like airport security? You know, with everything that happened in the past 8 years, you know, people were a lot of times were demanding. They would get people to demand something that they wanted to implement. Makes it much more easier to implement. And if you don't mind, there's actually a quote from Bertrand Russell, who wrote in his 1952 book Impacts of Science on Society. And I won't read the whole quote, but he basically says that that in the future it will be easier for governments. You know, he said governments will have much more control over individual mentality than they now have, even in totalitarian countries. And he said basically through diet injections and injunctions, and from a very early age, through education, that they would have the ability to destroy people's free will. And it said that from a very early age, to produce a sort of character and sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any serious criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible. So he wrote this in 1952, and the key phrase in that quote, I think, is where he says that that in the future governments will have more control, even more control than there is in totalitarian countries. So in countries where people view themselves as free, he said that there would be more control in those places than in typical totalitarian regimes that existed in the 40s and 50s.
That's an important point. It's really a psychological control grid that underlays the actual physical technological smart grid, and it together makes a devastatingly effective control grid, because people then not only desire their own control, their own enslavement in some key senses, but will actually be willing to pay top dollar for it because it's the fashionable thing to do. And that's a very interesting trick that they like to play on people. Well, okay.
Well, you know, that's a good point too, because, you know, think about everything. Think about everything we're doing. You know, and again, I have no problem with Facebook or any of these things, but it is interesting. We seem to crave to organize ourselves, and a lot of the businesses in Nazi Germany, the money didn't all come from the government, because that's difficult. The government really doesn't want to do that. They want private money to take care of most of these things. And if you think about how many people have spent money on iPhones, that the applications on the iPhone depend on knowing exactly where you're at. And the individual is happy to make those payments every month to pay for, you know, this advanced technology. In Nazi Germany, the businesses, in order to organize their companies, they would engage IBM, and they spent millions of dollars from private industry, not even from the Nazi regime, and that made it very easy. Once the Nazis, and then they also organized themselves into these trade unions or trade organizations. So the Nazis, when they took over, they really didn't have to start from scratch. And once there was a critical mass of people doing this, then they can enforce a rule saying you had to have an IBM machine if your company was of a certain size to organize your business. And then once that was in place, then the third step was to then take it over. But by then it was already organized, so they were essentially just shifting who was at the top of the organization.
Well, that's right, and those tricks still continue today, and that's why the CIA has front venture capital firms like InQtel, which provide seed money to Facebook, which then becomes all the rage and accomplishes exactly what the U.S. government was attempting to do with the Information Awareness Office, which was create these vast relational databases so that they could track who was interacting with who. Well, now we all sign up and give that information for free to Facebook and whoever is behind Facebook for free, and we actually enjoy doing it. So they do know how to make it into a game.
Exactly. I mean, if you can make it chic, if you can make it, you know, and I haven't looked into this, you know, completely, so I haven't verified that this is 100% true, but I have heard reports of law enforcement even using people's Facebook announcements or Facebook event announcements online to break down their door and, you know, find out what they're doing. And I think there's been cases where they've, you know, jumped into like a barbecue at a house and they thought it was going to be like a meth rave or something like that. And, there's been those misunderstandings.
It's a party, yes, and people end up getting tasered. I have seen stories about that. I can't quote the headline off the top of my head, but I have seen at least two or three stories in various newspapers around the world about that, and it does happen.
Right. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is that in the popular culture, right, and this is something I brought up in my broadcast, we see these things in popular culture. We see in The Simpsons, for example, they had this episode where, they want to keep track of Bart. Bart steals a cell phone, or he finds a lost cell phone, he starts using it, and the owner finds out and says, Dennis Leary, I think it is, and he tells them that they should keep the cell phone and just turn it on, the GPS tracking, so they could track the kid, and, so that, you know, they can handle this problem child. And then there's even a part where Marge Simpson says that that it's not wrong to spy on someone if you're trying to do it for their own good or something to that effect. And so that's very interesting. What I also found interesting was Andy Rooney saying that he didn't like airport security and how difficult it was becoming and how much time we had to wait. And again, that connects with people because I don't like waiting. And his solution was to tattoo everyone, and so that we would have a way of identifying safe, quote unquote, safe people. And and then he goes on to say, well, or we could have a chip, or we can have, you know, and then he maybe rattles off a couple of other options. But what's interesting is that, you know, that's exactly what happened in World War II, is that but again, it wasn't, people weren't craving it. It was forced. The Jews were forced to have numbers on their arms. And people, as far as, you know, there being any kind of controlled media or whatnot, people should ask themselves this question. How many people have heard about the numbers on the arms of Holocaust survivors? In my mind, at least coming from the Eastern, from the East Coast, that was talked about in school. That was on the general psyche. Everyone that I know, anyway, was that I talked to, knows that, yeah, Holocaust survivors, they have these numbers that you were used to identify them. But how many people know that those were actually IBM identification numbers that would correspond to a punch card, and that this human being was reduced down to? And that, to me, is very striking, that people are not aware of that, and we have Andy Rooney advocating tattooing ourselves for the purpose of social organization.
Absolutely. Well, we will be destroyed for our lack of historical knowledge, which is why it's so important to continue to keep this information circulating so that people can be aware of it and know what's happening as it happens. Well, we've covered many, many aspects of this, but just wrapping up here, are there any other things that you'd like to throw out about this topic or things that you'd like to cover?
Well, just for, you know, people to, you know, to study their research, you know what I'm saying, to study their history, and really, you know, once you start going down that road of, you know, examining today based on, you know, not based on, you know, what the pundits are saying, you know, what, you know, flipping back from CNN to Fox News to so-called get two different perspectives is really not going to give you really a clear view of current events. And you know, I avoid at all costs to get my news visually, because it's a very powerful medium and it's a very powerful way to manipulate perceptions and things like that. So I would just say, you know, history is repeating itself with regard to the global control grid. It's also repeating itself with regard to the financial system, which, I mean, we could do a whole other show on just on that. The same things that happened in the late 1800s in the financial systems are now happening on a global scale. We can get into that another time. And really, that's the biggest thing, is that all these things have been the so-called, you know, there's really nothing new under the sun. And, you know, really, if people want to know what's going on and know what to expect coming down, they really only need to look to history. And through your show, I've seen the various topics that you have, and you're bringing a lot of this stuff to light. And I ask people to, you know, keep listening and to get as much of the information they can from reading and from firsthand research.
Absolutely, I agree with that. And of course, the control grid extends out into many other areas, so I'd be happy to have you on again in the future to talk about some of those other topics. But in the meantime, fire out your coordinates so the listeners can find some of your excellent work.
Absolutely. Again, it's corruptionradio.com. I'd ask all your listeners to please call and subscribe. There, you can subscribe on the right panel. There's a listener page. Also, people can call up and leave me voicemails. That's 702-560-1948. Again, that's 702-560-1948. And they can listen to this show streaming. It's live on Saturday nights, and it usually posts about a day later. And also they can email me at jordan@corruptionradio.com. And every email I get is read by me personally. And if there's something I can use on the show, I'll read it on the show as well.
Right, excellent. Well, it was good talking to you, and I'm certainly hope we can talk to each other again. Jordan Kaufman, thank you for joining me today.
Okay, it was a pleasure.